I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Joining us today for The American Idea. I am Kara Rogers Stevens, Associate Professor of History at Ashland University. If you are like me, you may have noticed the topic of foreign policy, and specifically expanding America's borders in one way or another, has been in the headlines lately. Well, we here at The American Idea podcast thought it might be quite useful to speak to an historian who has some expertise in foreign policy issues so that we can have the broader context necessary for understanding what's really at stake now in 2025. So we invited Professor Dan Monroe to come on the program. Dr. Monroe is the John C. Griswold Distinguished Professor of History at Millikan University. He earned his doctorate from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and he's the author of three books, The Republican Vision of John Tyler, At Home with Illinois' Governors, and Shapers of the Great Debate on the Civil War. And I understand that you're also currently working on a fourth book at the moment. Is that right, Dr. Monroe?
That's correct. I've been laboring on a biography of James K. Polk that my PhD advisor partially completed before his passing away. And I'm also doing a narrative history of the Civil War.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. Yeah. But then, of course, some of our listeners might be familiar with you because you frequently teach courses in our Master's Degree in American History and Government program, or our MAG program. So it's a pleasure to get to talk to you. Welcome back to the American Idea podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. And it's a delight to be part of the MAG program.
Well, the question of whether or when or how Americans should expand has been a topic of debate since the founding era. And to my mind, one of the most interesting framings of this topic is actually not from a conversation directly about expansion, but rather from a debate over whether or not to continue importing enslaved people. And this debate occurred during the Constitutional Convention. And it was a conversation where John Rutledge from South Carolina asserted, and I'm going to quote him here, "Religion and humanity have nothing to do with this question. Interest alone is the governing principle with nations." I always like talking with my students about that phrase, interest alone is the governing principle with nations. So, of course, Rutledge has a point. The point of a country is to act in the best interests of its own citizens. And of course, that involves interest when it comes to foreign policy. But John Rutledge is asserting something here that maybe some might question whether this is really an American value to say religion and humanity don't matter, interest alone. That's what should guide us when it comes to national decision making. Contrast that with George Washington's farewell address of 1796. This is George Washington retiring from the presidency, giving advice not only to Americans of his day, but also to future generations. I wonder whether you think that Washington would agree with Rutledge. What was Washington's position on how nations should make their foreign policy decisions? Would he also believe that interest alone is the governing principle, or did he have a different view on how Americans should approach foreign policy decisions in particular?
Well, that's a great question. And Washington had been president at a very turbulent period in the 1790s, as you know. During the course of the 1790s, there was the French Revolution. There were tensions with Great Britain. And there was great enthusiasm in the colonies for the French Revolution, enthusiasm to the point of tension between Americans who maybe didn't feel so enthusiastic about the French Revolution. So in his farewell address, Washington cautions against what he calls excessive hatred for one nation and excessive affection for a nation. You know, he seems to suggest people shouldn't get so passionate and so caught up in the affairs of foreign nations, because that was unhealthy for the body politic. Mm-hmm. And further, of course, he cautioned against any kind of a permanent or entangling alliances. And this becomes something of a watchword or a guiding principle in American foreign policy. You know, the United States was the anti-colonial ideal. It had broken away from Great Britain and essentially condemned the British colonial policy and established a course as the as a republic that was committed to charting a non-imperial course. And that's the template that Washington sets. So I think Washington would be an aficionado of what might be referred to as real politic. It is taking the world as it is. So that would be similar to what Rutledge has said. That is to say, nations are governed by interest or self-interest rather than some profound moral principles. And Washington suggests, well, we should stay out of the perpetual quarrels associated with Europe. We can make alliances with them under extraordinary circumstances. I think he uses modifier extraordinary. You know, under unusual circumstances, we could have an alliance with a foreign nation. But beyond that, we should just stay the heck out and pursue our own interests. And recognize that those are different from the nations of Europe.
So Washington presenting an isolationist view, perhaps, in this foreign policy section of the address. The one word that he would maybe add to a Rutledge-like statement, and I'm going to quote Washington here from his address.
Sure.
He says, if we remain one people under an efficient government, the period is not far off when we may defy material injury from external annoyance, when we may take such an attitude as will cause the neutrality we may at any time resolve upon to be scrupulously respected, when belligerent nations, under the impossibility of making acquisitions upon us, will not lightly hazard the giving us provocation, when we may choose war or peace, as our interest, guided by justice, shall counsel. And I love that framing of the statement. So Washington absolutely is hoping and predicting Americans can avoid war, they can retain a neutral status, they can be respected by belligerent nations and not hassled. And Americans can choose whether to go to war or remain at peace, using interest, absolutely. So he agrees with Rutledge, but he adds justice. Our interest, guided by justice, shall counsel the decisions that we make regarding war and peace. Maybe a little bit more satisfactory approach for me as somebody who's maybe not a big fan of John Rutledge of South Carolina and his pro-slavery position. I prefer the Washingtonian view there.
I would just add that we might want to modify calling Washington an isolationist, because he does suggest that commerce is perfectly fine. You know, we should have commerce with the world. We should have a good business relationship with Europe. We should join together in making money and being prosperous. So he doesn't necessarily want to pull up the ramp and, you know, have nothing to do with them, but he just says, you know, essentially we don't need to get involved in their perpetual wars and political disputes.
Yeah, that's a really good distinction. I totally agree. Well, moving on from Washington's advice, there's another important document from the early years of the American Republic that's not as well known, maybe it should be. I'm referring to a speech that was given by John Quincy Adams on July 4th, 1821. And at the time that he gave the speech, Adams was Secretary of State. Of course, he's a remarkable politician who served many different roles, including president, congressman, senator. But at this point, he was Secretary of State. And the best line from this speech, I think, is when Adams says about America, "Wherever the standard of freedom and independence has been or shall be unfurled, There will her heart, her benedictions, and her prayers be, but she goes not abroad in search of monsters to destroy. Dan, what did John Quincy Adams mean when he said that? So what was he recommending when it comes to foreign policy?
Well, I think it's so emblematic of this sense of American exceptionalism that inclines Adams as, and it just has to be said too, kind of parenthetically, that Adams was one of the great secretaries of state the country ever had. I mean, he did a magnificent job. And so Adams is embracing the idea that, look, we're an anti-colonial power. We're not pursuing an empire the way the Brits are, or the French, or whoever else. You know, we are the United States. We're going to set an example to the world of democracy and republicanism with a small r. But that's all. You know, we're not going to go out and try to force that down people's throats. Or to create a kind of colonial empire the way the Brits are. You know, we're not going to go, and it's a great metaphor, we're not going to go out and search for monsters to destroy. We're going to stay within our own boundaries. We're blessed by these oceans. Mm-hmm. And also we have a continent to expand into. So there isn't any reason for us to go abroad. And it just bears noting. And maybe you're going to get to it. So if I'm getting ahead of you, I apologize. But it just bears noting that, of course, 2 years later, James Monroe, at Quincy Adams' urging, promulgates the Monroe Doctrine, which says, you know, basically the Central and South America are off limits for further European colonialism. So, again, the United States establishing itself as a kind of anti-colonial bastion.
So why did John Quincy encourage Monroe to make that statement? Why was that necessary in 1823?
Well, there were some British, meddling in, countries in Central and South America were gradually breaking away from Spain, establishing themselves as independent nations. And there was some concern that these fledgling republics would be vulnerable to rapacious colonial powers like Great Britain. And so it was a kind of metaphorical shot across the bow to Europe saying, look, as these fledgling republics get established, that doesn't mean you should kind of parachute in and say, okay, we're going to be the next, colonial, we're going to add these to our kind of colonial necklace. Yeah. And, stay out of this region. Now, it just has to be said that the United States had such a woefully tiny military establishment that it couldn't really enforce the Monroe Doctrine. So the Monroe Doctrine was essentially enforced by the British Navy. And I think the Brits kind of tacitly accepted that. But be that as it may, it's still a profound statement of American foreign policy in the period.
Now, do you think this is a statement of interest or of justice or both?
Well, I think it's both. Maybe you would agree. I mean, I think it's clearly it's in the American interest for these fledgling countries to establish themselves as republics, mm-hmm. And join the United States in this great kind of republican with a small r experiment. But it's also a matter of justice, too, in that, I think of Henry Clay's a speech that Henry Clay gave during this period in which he endorses this concept of, the United States being kind of the helpmate, at least ideologically, of countries that are establishing themselves as republics. And that's what that I think is the American conception. You know, it's you're back to kind of the Puritan ideal of, be as a city, a light shining upon a hill, a city upon a hill that the world can look to. You don't physically intervene, but you stand as a kind of ideological ideal. And I think that's what Quincy's. So, it's interest and justice, I think. Quincy Adams does a magnificent job of saying that.
So Americans are seeing themselves as giving the rest of the world an example of self-government. And they are proud to see these Southern American nations following in that example. And they're kind of taking a big brother approach by saying in this Monroe Doctrine, we're not going to support any European meddling or allow any European meddling. That's an interesting foreign policy. And I agree with you. That seems to be both in American interests and also something that could be asserted to be a move in the favor of justice. How did this affect our relations with the rest of the world? Was this Monroe Doctrine respected by and large?
Well, that's a great question. And I think it, I would say somewhat, in that I do think that thanks in part to the Brits, that there's less aggression in Central and South America post-1823 than there might have been absent any kind of Monroe Doctrine. Having said that, there are still incidents where, you know, you have one of these fledgling South American republics default on its debt obligations, and some European power parachutes in through its navy and engages in some, you know, aggressive acts to kind of restart debt payments. I mean, those things, they're isolated, but those things do happen on occasion in the 19th century. It's something that the United States was opposed to. And in fact, of course, that leads to the Roosevelt corollary, the Monroe Doctrine during his presidency. Mm-hmm. The idea of the United States should kind of police the hemisphere rather than having European powers come parachuting in every time they have some kind of dispute. So I guess what I'm saying, mm-hmm. it was imperfect, but it was, I think, still an idealistic statement that set a tone.
Yeah, you mentioned the Roosevelt corollary. So this is President Theodore Roosevelt, 1904.
Right.
And this extension to the Monroe Doctrine, as you say, instead of just saying we're going to oppose European intervention here in the Western Hemisphere, Roosevelt is actually justifying sending American forces into other parts of the Western Hemisphere. Does this mark a sea change for American foreign policy?
Well, I would characterize it as a this is a great question. I mean, here we are. We're at the end of the beginning of the 20th century, but the United States in the 1880s and 1890s is kind of swept into. I use the verb swept because I think it's not only by events in the world, but also a kind of cultural change. You know, at the end of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about 1870s, 1880s. The United States emerges as the world's leading economy, becomes a net exporter for the first time in the history of the country. And the Industrial Revolution post-Civil War goes great guns. And there's a kind of growing sense among what I would characterize as the American elite, you know, diplomats, intellectuals, military officers, politicians, you know, people thinking about the country's destiny, that the United States really should have a substantive position in the world beyond a kind of wishing everyone well and being, you know, the kind mm-hmm. of John Quincy Adams, we wish everyone well, but we're not going to be and go in search of monsters to destroy. Now there's a sense that, look, as a great emerging nation that's becoming the world's leading economy, we should have a role on the world stage. We deserve to have a role on the world stage. Mm-hmm. And we should embrace that leadership rather than be repelled by it. So this is the backdrop for Roosevelt's corollary. There's a dispute in 1904 between Venezuela and Britain and Germany over debt payments. And the Germans actually send a portion of their navy to Venezuela to start the, you know, the traditional, you know, holding a gun to their head kind of a thing. And so Roosevelt says, look, you know, we're going to, if there are instances where nations in Central and South America default on their debt, we're not going to tolerate having you steam in with your navy and sink their gunboats and blow up their harbor until they repay. We're going to handle that. And if we have to, we'll send our troops in and we'll do what we have to do to restart those payments, but not you. You stay the hell out. Mm-hmm. And so it does mark a bit of a sea change, and it's a product of that kind of ideological change that starts in the 1880s. I mean, I talk about it in class as a kind of cultural phenomenon in that if you look at the end of the 19th century, the newspapers in the United States are covering a lot of stories about colonial adventurism on the part of the Brits. You know, think of Gordon in Khartoum. You know, Charles Gordon, the British general who insisted on staying in Khartoum, even though he was surrounded by this gigantic Islamist army. There was this relief force coming to get him, and he was supposed to get out of there, and he stayed, and he ends up being killed and beheaded, becomes this huge martyr. All that's covered in a kind of breathless way in the newspapers. Or think of Livingston finding Stanley, you know, the explorers, the Scottish missionary who was lost in what today is Tanzania, and is found by this other explorer after being, you know, vanished in Central Africa for years. Again, covered by the newspapers. Anyway, the point is that there's a certain sense of heady adventurism that's associated with this. Now, the United States retains this kind of anti-colonial sensibility, but it's being tempered a bit by the idea of, well, as a great and powerful nation, we too should have a role on the world stage, and we shouldn't be repelled by that. And there's a certain what I always suggest is there's a certain romanticism that's associated with that too.
Yeah.
You know, think of Theodore Roosevelt, resigning as Secretary of the Navy and raising a regiment of cowboys and going to Cuba and somehow managing not to get killed. I mean, by, you know, leading these charges up hills in Cuba occupied by Spanish troops with really good rifles. So, but you know, there's, I guess what I try to describe to my students is a kind of holistic, you know, change that involves not only ideologically thinking, intellectually thinking, well, we should become as a great and powerful economy and as an exceptional nation that is a democratic example, democratic with a small d example to the world, we should have a role. And then there's also this cultural component too. Isn't this romantic? Isn't this exciting? You know, there's a world out there to be explored. And of course, this is coupled, as you know, with the end of the frontier in the United States. You think of Frederick Jackson Turner's, great essay in the 1890s, noting that, well, the frontier is over and there's no other place that is going to be settled by descendants of Europeans on the North American continent. So anyway, you have all that mishmash that feeds into things like the Roosevelt Corollary.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country, and they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
So on the one hand, Americans are still thinking of themselves as this exceptional nation in terms of Declaration of Independence, belief in equality of mankind, commitment to consent of the governed. And on the other hand, it sounds like you're describing for us a real itch and a real temptation to maybe follow in the example of some of the great European powers and maybe dabble in some colonial projects. But there's definitely a tension there. So I immediately start to think about the Spanish and American War. Maybe you can tell us a little bit, what were the debates going on amongst Americans when it came to intervening in this conflict between the Spanish colonial overlords and the Cubans who are fighting for their freedom? Did those who supported getting involved in this war see themselves as kind of following in the footsteps of President Monroe, or is this is part of the sea change and the Roosevelt's move toward intervention and keeping Europeans out actively? What's going on there?
Yeah, I think that's the latter. You know, I mean, Cuba, of course, is very close to the United States, and there had been an abortive revolt against Spanish rule that lasted about 10 years from 1868 to 1878 that failed. And in the wake of that, there was a fair number of Cubans who were exiled to the United States. It restarts in that Cuban revolt in 1895. There's great sympathy in the United States for it. There's an exile community in the United States that's lobbying for American intervention on the part on the behalf of Cuban exiles. But it's also American interest is also a product of all those things we just discussed. I mean, that, you know, this kind of culture of, you know, embracing the romanticism of imperialism, and also this kind of a sense of American exceptionalism because of the tremendous American economy and the belief that the American system of government and life is a good and virtuous one. And so exporting it is not necessarily a bad thing. The end of the frontier, but you still have an ethos of kind of perpetual expansionism. All that feeds into the conflict. And it just has to be said that I don't think William McKinley was president of the United States during the Spanish-American War, elected in 1896. McKinley was the last president who was a veteran of the Civil War. McKinley was kind of a staid fellow. I don't think McKinley saw himself, you know, when he took office as someone who was going to lead any kind of imperial crusade. In the spring, winter and spring of 1898, you know, he had a series of events that after years of coverage, newspaper coverage of some rather savage efforts on the part of the Spanish government to suppress the Cuban revolt. On top of that, then you had events in the spring of 1898, like the U.S. battleship Maine blowing up in the harbor of Havana in February of 1898. Mm.
And everybody thought the Spanish did that on purpose, even though it turned out to be an accident.
What people think now, right? Those powder magazines were highly combustible and just blew up.
Yeah.
But people assumed that the Spanish were behind it. Then there was an insulting note that the Spanish minister to the United States had written to someone in Cuba that the rebels got a hold of and published, and there was insulting language regarding McKinley in it. And, you know, it's the middle of the newspaper feud between Hearst and Pulitzer. You know, when the Spanish minister's letter is revealed, the headline is worst insult in the history of the country, you know, to McKinley. Anyway, this is a long way of saying that I think McKinley, his hand was somewhat forced by events, and he felt that in April and March of April of 1898, he really had to act. He didn't really have any kind of, you know, the events had, you know, dictated his course. So he asked Congress for a declaration of war against Spain, and then you get John Hay's splendid little war where, you know, from April to August of 1898, the United States runs roughshod over Spain with its modern new steel navy and a kind of ragtag militia army that manages to win in Cuba. Although, lots of people die from disease, but
So that could be classified as searching for monsters to destroy. American intervention on the side of the Cubans to help them gain their independence from this colonial power. But in an unfortunate turn of events, America came out of that conflict with some of its own colonies, most remarkably the Philippines, and the Filipinos engaged in their own rebellion against the United States. And this leads to a real crisis of conscience in America, doesn't it? What are the arguments that are being raised for and against what was by that point really just imperialism on America's part in the wake of this conflict?
Yeah, that's right. You know, and it bears noting, I'm glad you brought it up, because this what you just described and what I just described you know, Spanish Spanish-American War, and then the aftermath of that with the Philippines becoming an American colony in essence, and Cuba, although independent, only nominally so. Mm-hmm. And then Puerto Rico and Guam becoming American colonies. You know, this is part of the settlement. It certainly is antithetical to the tradition that we described at the beginning of the program of not, you know, the Quincy Adams outline. Mm-hmm. And that was wildly controversial in the United States. There was a colossal debate in the Senate over the whether to ratify the treaty that ended the war, because the treaty included these colonies. Yeah. And the United States acquiring kind of a little, you know, a little tiny colonial empire, but a colonial empire nonetheless. And the anti-imperialists argued, you know, essentially echoed Quincy Adams and George Washington. You know, what, why, you know, this is not what we do. We're the anti-colonial power. This is antithetical to American ideals, to American tradition. It's a threat to our, you know, the essentially the nature and character of our experiment. It'll lead to the creation of a gigantic army. You know, it bears noting, and I think a lot of people forget this because we have post-World War II, we have such a large military establishment thanks to the Cold War, and it's persisted. Right. But the United States traditionally had an absolutely tiny army. It was one of the smallest in the world. Now, it had, it over time, developed a robust navy, but really the robust navy is really a post-1890s, you know, phenomenon. So you have the, you know, and so the anti-imperialists said, well, look, if we're going to keep the you know, we're going to have to police these areas that are scattered all over the globe. We're going to have to have a, we're going to have to blow up the military establishment. And all of our traditions are opposed to this. You know, small R republicanism warns against the creation of this gigantic national security state, because that's traditionally where threats to free government come from.
And you have to raise taxes in order to support that military.
Absolutely. You end up with this, you know, a much larger federal government with all kinds of ramifications that are antithetical to the American tradition. And then there are objections on the part of American business who worry that their products will come into the United States that will be cheaper than native produced products, and so you'll have the, you know, their businesses will be undercut by foreign competition that are part of this colonial empire. And then of course there are racists who argue that, look, you know, we're not a country that should be you know, involved in, with or having colonies that are filled with people that are of a different color than the majority of Americans. So they're the, you know, the anti-imperial argument is very strong and very robust, and it's on multiple levels.
Right. And ironically, there are imperialists who would also use racist arguments to justify their enterprise. And this is kind of a take on the white man's burden that some of our audience members might be familiar with. There's a famous Rudyard Kipling poem about how tough it is to be a white person in the age of imperialism, because there's this burden put on one as a member of the superior race to enlighten savage nations and bring them along toward civilization. And that's how a lot of, for example, English people justified their empires overseas. It seems like that language crept into some Americans' thinking as well, that America needed to civilize the Philippines in order for the Filipino people to become qualified to govern themselves. So we're not totally getting rid of the Declaration of Independence ideas, but we're adding some addendums and saying, well, people can only govern themselves once they've reached the right level of civilization to get to that stage. And I love some of the anti-imperialists reaching back to the founding generation to oppose this. So, for example, William Jennings Bryan has this great speech where he really relies on Washington, Jefferson. And he quotes Jefferson at one point saying, "If there be one principle more deeply rooted than any other in the mind of every American, it is that we should have nothing to do with conquest." And again, he said, "Conquest is not in our principles. It is inconsistent with our government." Of course, it undermines this, the basis of the American regime. If people are not qualified to govern themselves, what makes Americans qualified to govern ourselves? And what, all men are not really created equal, if that is the case. But the anti-imperialists lost the argument. Am I right about that?
Yes, that's right. You know, there's a famous anecdote that that may or may not be true, that William McKinley got down on his knees and prayed about, you know, whether to support the retaining the Philippines as a colony.
Yeah.
And the word that he got was, yes, we should, for all the reasons that you, you know, described, or that the anti-imperialists were critical of. That is to say, he felt it was the white man's burden. There was an obligation to take care of these poor and fortunate Filipinos until such time as they were fit to govern themselves. So, but you know, my view is that you know, when I Theodore Roosevelt talks about this in his speech to the Naval Academy in 1897, there's this kind of heady sense that the United States has reached this point in its maturity where it's prepared to take on these burdens and should take on these burdens in order to be a truly great nation. Mm-hmm. And if conflict comes, well, then that's a good thing, because conflict makes for a virtuous citizenry. You know, I mean, Roosevelt was somewhat derisive about the idea of, well, it's a good thing that we have business and it's important to have commerce for economic growth and all those good reasons, but we don't want to simply be a nation of shopkeepers. You know, we want to have a martial element too as well, and that martial element, that blade needs sharpening occasionally. And so his whole rift to the Naval War College is in essence talking about some of the virtues that come from war. And not necessary to shy away from that, not necessarily covet it, but on the other hand, if it's part of the destiny of a country, then embrace that destiny.
Yeah. How did that work out for us? What's the end of the story of the Spanish-American War and the Philippine conflict?
Well, as you know, there was a colossal revolt in the Philippines that lasted a couple of years. That was featured tremendous atrocities on both sides. A lot of bloodletting. More, I think there was 4,000 American troops were killed in the Philippines in the wake of the war. More than were killed against Spain. Suppressing the Filipino revolt. So, you know, the Filipinos simply transferred their animus against their Spanish overlords to the Americans. And there was the Filipino nationalist movement, you know, wreaked havoc for a while and then was suppressed. So, you know, this is, of course, the story of the 20th century, is that American involvement, you know, the United States has become a world power, has become a player on the world stage, but there have been costs and setbacks. And there's a kind of push-pull between real politic and idealism, what I would characterize as a kind of Rooseveltian or Reaganist real politic, or Nixonian real politic, and then the Wilsonian idealism, you know, in other words, believing that we can remake the world in a better way, and then a real politics saying, well, actually, no, we can't. you know, we can exist in the world, and we can pursue our interests in the world, but it's folly to suggest that we can fix the world, that we can, you know, mold it and shape it into our own image. And that's I think that one of the best ways to characterize American foreign policy is a kind of push-pull between those two competing ideas.
So frame this for us in terms of Washington and his advice. Washington, as you said, is taking the world on its own terms. He argued against entangling alliances. He was for commerce, but he was concerned about becoming overly involved with other nations. He's aware that America needs to act in accordance with its own interests, but also is concerned with justice. Is his advice still applicable to us today? Can we still act according to what he recommended? Or has the world just changed too much? Do we have a different reality that we have to deal with now?
No, I think Washington's principles are timeless, and his advice is absolutely sound, and is worth emulating. I mean, Washington's argument was, well, we should have commerce with all, but we should avoid entangling alliances with everyone. Of course, we should have a kind of, trade that benefits us and other nations. But we should be leery about being drawn into every dispute and quarrel, because mm-hmm. the world is full of disputes and quarrels. I mean, it's absolutely sound. And also, I was rereading this in preparation for today, and I was so struck by his comment about avoid excessive hatred for another nation, but also avoid excessive enthusiasm for other nations. You know.
Those are both forms of slavery?
Yes, exactly. Yes, mm-hmm. Avoid this kind of sense that, you forget that as Americans, our interest is advancing our interests, mm-hmm. and don't get swept away into the cause célèbre of the moment. Or some other, you feel such a romantic attachment to another nation, or such a detest. Yeah. For another nation, that you consider that paramount, which is, I think, in many respects, Washington's commenting obviously on the 1790s, but it's a timeless warning. That's absolutely right. We should be, and I think the bottom line to Washington is, we should be dispassionate in our approach to foreign policy. We shouldn't be, swept away by our passions. As the world swirls around it, we need to step back and think calmly and lucidly about what our national interest is and act accordingly. I mean, Washington was James Thomas Flexner say? The indispensable man.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it's absolutely true.
Yeah. If only we still had presidents. I don't know that we could ever have a president like Washington again. He kind of set the standard so high, it became impossible for anybody else to live up to. But my word, it's a very good thing he was our first.
It was an exceptional generation.
It was, indeed. Well, thank you so much, Dan, for your perspective on American history and the way that our foreign policy objectives have changed over the years. Hopefully this has been useful to our audience members as they consider the decisions that are being made on the world stage today. And when can we expect your latest works to be coming out? Do we have a release?
Well, I've been laboring on these for a while, and I can't give you a kind of a date, but and I have an onerous course load of 4-4.
Oh boy.
But having said that, I hope to complete them in the near future.
Okay. Well, we look forward to reading them and talking to you about them again in the future.
Thanks so much.
All righty. Thank you for joining me today on The American Idea.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.